Let's turn to Revelation 18. Revelation 18. If you don't have the notes, they're at the back, the copies of the notes. As we bring this to a conclusion, we're almost at the point of the return of Christ in the book of Revelation. In Revelation chapter 19, we will see the Lord Jesus Christ returning. But just before he returns, the mystery Babylon the Great will be destroyed. The city of Babylon, which seems to be the capital of the Antichrist empire, will be destroyed. Now let's just read from verse 8 to verse 24. Last week we looked at the first seven verses of Revelation 18. And let's start at verse 8 today. Everybody found it? Verse 8 says, "Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. And the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in one hour is thy judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise any more. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all thyine wood and all manner vessels of ivory and all manner vessels of most precious wood and of brass and iron and marble, and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flowers, wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and souls of men. And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things, which were made rich by her, shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in one hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the companies and ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off, and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads, and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea, by reason of her costliness, for in one hour she made desolate. Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up like a great millstone, and cast it unto the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. And no craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in thee. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. And the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." Amen, and God will bless that reading of his word. Now, I mentioned this last week. This chapter is a very frightening chapter, terrifying, sobering chapter of God's word, where we see God's power just poured out upon this city of Babylon. This very self-confident, this very proud city is going to feel the heat of God's anger. It was a city that was the devil's monument to sin. It was like a It was like his citadel, his capital of sin. And God is going to turn that city that was a monument to sin and make it rather a monument of judgment, a monument of God's anger against sin and against sinners. Now, notice it's very sudden. Verse 8 says, shall her plagues come in one day? This is not over a period of months. This is a sudden, instant, complete destruction. It says in verse 8, she shall be utterly burned with fire. Not just a part. Everything about this city is just completely destroyed. Do you remember a city in the Old Testament this happened to? Another wicked city? Sodom and Gomorrah. Do you remember these two cities of Sodom and Gomorrah? And God rained down fire and brimstone and destroyed those two cities. Interesting, it says, as it was in the days of Lot, so shall it be in the days when the Son of Man comes. Maybe that's how God will destroy Babylon, the same way, pouring out fire and brimstone from heaven upon this great city, the capital of the Antichrist Empire. Old Mr. Spurgeon put it in a very poetic way when he described the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He said this, God rained hell out of heaven because he poured out the fire and brimstone from heaven upon Sodom and Gomorrah. And he's going to do the same here with Babylon. He's going to rain hell upon this city and utterly destroy it. Now, there's going to be three groups of people who will be upset. Now, there will be other people upset, of course. The Antichrist and the false prophet are clearly not in the city when it's destroyed because they're going to be destroyed in the next chapter, Revelation 19, at the Battle of Armageddon. If you see your little map of the Middle East there, wherever it is, page 4 of your notes, Babylon, or ancient Babylon, is there on the river Ur. Ur on the river Euphrates, and the Tigris runs nearby. And the Euphrates River runs all the way to what's called the Persian Gulf. By the way, they don't like you calling it the Persian Gulf. Some of them get upset. The Saudi Arabians don't like you calling it the Persian Gulf because the Persians are Iranians. And they say, no, the Iranians are not the best. We are the best. So you have to be careful when you say Persian Gulf. But we'll call it Persian Gulf because that's how the name that we use in geography. The Persian Gulf, the Armageddon, if you go from the river Euphrates, go towards Israel, Armageddon, or the plain of Megiddo, that area, we'll look at it in more detail when we do Revelation 19, is from the Mount Carmel, where Elijah was, all the way down to the city of Jerusalem. That's where the Battle of Armageddon is going to be fought. So the Antichrist and the false prophet, they are not clearly in the city of Babylon when God destroys it here in Revelation 18. But there are three groups who are outside the city who are very upset when they see it destroyed in an hour, in one moment of time. And of course, they cry the most because they have the most invested in Babylon. Now, what are these three groups? We'll go through them. Number one, verse 9 tells us, the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her. So, if you remember, the Antichrist will come from a confederacy of 10 kings, we're told. He has 10, remember, 10 horns to represent that in the symbol of the beast. He will emerge from those 10 kings and dominate those 10 kings. And those 10 kings will submit to the Antichrist when he takes control of the world. So these 10 kings, now they may not be literally kings, they may be governments. The word king or the horn there just represents a ruler. It doesn't literally have to be one king. Could be one king, but it could be a ruler of some sort. Maybe prime minister or president. These 10 kings who have submitted themselves, surrendered their sovereignty to the Antichrist, pulled their sovereignty to submit to the Antichrist, because he has promised them wealth and prosperity. He has promised them influence. And you're seeing it now, aren't you, in the world right now, because we have two big superpowers vying here in this area of the world. Who are they? China and the United States. And everybody's trying to get in with the biggest. Everyone's trying to see who's going to be the biggest dog in the fight when it comes down to the fight. Well, this is what's going to happen when the Antichrist comes. These 10 kings, they're going to go to him, join with him, because they think he's going to be the key for their prosperity in the future, sucking up to the Antichrist, keeping in with his empire. So when they see Babylon, the citadel, the center of the Antichrist empire, just burning up in 1 hour, it's as if all their hopes and dreams are burning up. They've invested everything. They have led their people to surrender to the Antichrist. They have humbled themselves in public, humiliated themselves to submit to the Antichrist. And kings are not normally the humblest people. So they've had to swallow a lot of their pride in order to achieve the prosperity that the Antichrist promises. And now they look at Babylon completely destroyed, and they start to wail and they moan. They shall bewail her and lament. That means they don't just, it's not just a little bit of unhappiness, uneasiness. This is great sorrow. Everything they've invested in has now been destroyed politically. Now, we don't know if these 10 kings or 10 rulers are watching this from a distance, you know, a few miles away from the city. Most likely, they're watching on the internet or satellite television. They're just seeing this happen the way you and I saw the 9/11 disaster happen. You remember when the towers came down? We weren't, none of us in the room were physically present, but we all remember seeing it. And the shock and the horror of seeing those two great towers just collapse in the matter of minutes. Well, that's kind of what's going to happen, I believe, with these 10 rulers. They're going to be watching from a distance, maybe on television, maybe through the internet, and they see this great city, which is the richest, most powerful place on the planet at that time, just be completely obliterated by God in less than 1 hour. Just burn to smithereens. Now, when that happens, and the whole world is tied together by that city, and that empire is tied together, then there's chaos, because nobody knows what to do. There's no means of communication. That was the place that gave you all your orders. That was the place that controlled all the money. That was the place that controlled all the trade. That was the place that controlled all the politics. And when that disappears, and all those people who are in it disappear, you can imagine there's confusion. Nobody knows what to do they? Nobody knows what's going to happen next. Nobody knows who's in control. And these kings, they begin to realize they backed the wrong horse. They were following the Antichrist instead of the real Christ. They made a blunder. They made a huge mistake. But then there's a second group, John tells us. And verse 11, we're told the merchants. That's another way of saying the business people, the MNCs, the big corporations, the guys who've made the big money, big influence, the tycoons, from their relationship to the city of Babylon, from taking the mark of the beast. They've been the most successful. And these business people, they weep and mourn over the city. But verse 11 concludes with a very interesting insight into human nature. They're not weeping because they saw the city burning to pieces and all these people burned alive. They're not bothered about that. What's bothering them? Notice what it says, verse 11. For no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. You see, the God of these business people was business. That was their God. That's what drew them to the Antichrist in the first place, to get rich, to make money, to do business. And now that their business investments have been decimated and destroyed before their very eyes, their heart's broken. Not broken because someone has died. Thousands of people have died. Maybe millions have died. They're broken because their investments have dried up. They've lost out. That's the real God in their life. This money and making cash. And what do they say? They say, the merchandise of gold, verse 12, and silver and precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, fine wood, ivory, wood, brass, iron, marble, cinnamon, odors, ointment, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour and wheat, beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and chariots of men. Now, I've read that list. How many here in this room have any of those things in their houses? Most of us have maybe one or two, yeah? Maybe a handful. When you go down to NTUC, you don't go down and order, oh, I need silver, gold, pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet. That's not what you need, is it, on a day-to-day basis? What's a simple way of summing up that whole list? Give me a word.
Luxuries, isn't it?
These are the people, you know, today you see them, these big, you go down Orchard Road and they go into those stores, these designer label stores. You buy a handbag, it costs you $20,000. I don't know why anybody would pay $20,000 for a handbag. Or a pair of shoes. And I'm picking on the ladies, but I could also pick on some of the stupid men, you know. Buying a belt for $1,000. It's just going to hold your trousers up, that's all, nothing more. You know? And there are people who come over, fly from all parts of the world, don't they? And they come down Orchard Road, and they go past all the other cheaper shops, and they say, oh, no, I've got to go, because it says CK, Calvin Klein, or Armani. It's made in the same factory in China, it just has a different name, that's all, as the one in NTUC. But that's the world, isn't it? They need these luxuries. They need these brands to make them feel superior. And they strut around, don't they, in their designer cars and their designer clothes with their designer perfumes, going to the designer restaurants to eat, to the designer nightclubs, to live in the designer condos and houses, all to create the impression of luxury and wealth. And what's going to happen? The whole thing burns up in 1 hour. And they're weeping and wailing, these merchants, because their luxuries have been destroyed. The things that they really loved more than anything else, the thing that they craved, that was the God of their lives. You see, the Antichrist, they don't worship the Antichrist because he's their God. They only worship the Antichrist in order to get to the God they really want, the money. That's all. In the case of the kings of the earth, what's their God? Power, influence, diplomacy, people kowtowing to them when they walk into a room. But these business people, their God is materialism. You see, here's something you need to learn about the devil. The devil knows humanity. He knows that we're not all the same. We're not all tempted by the same things, or at least to the same degree. He knows that Singapore women over 20 years of age have a different temptation from Singapore women under 20 years of age. He knows what tempts Filipino women is different from what tempts Singapore women. He knows what tempts men is different from women, and he knows what type of temptation to put in the heart or the mind of a different type of man. He knows a certain men, certain women are attracted by money. Others are not interested in money. They live for power. They live for fame. They live for people to respect them and fear them. Money's not so important. Other people live to be sports stars, to be worshipped, to be admired for their abilities. A lot of business people are not worried about being admired for the way they look. You take Donald Trump, he's not bothered. He wears any old suit. He's got that weird hairstyle. He's not bothered. He just come in and the suit's hanging off him and away he goes. He wants to be respected for being a tycoon, not for how he looks. But there are people who are obsessed with how they look and being admired, and they go through all kinds of weird operations just to make themselves look another day younger. The devil knows all this. He knows which God fits the person, which idol is the idol that really draws their heart. And here you see a classic illustration of it. The kings of the earth, they're upset for one reason, one God that they've lost, the God of power. The merchant people, they're upset because they've lost the God of wealth. That was their God. You know, many very wealthy people are reclusive. They don't want anybody to know them. They don't want fame. They want to hide away. They don't want to even take a photograph of them. But their God is money. And that's what's happened here. They've lost all of these things, and they're very upset. They're very angry. And they said in verse 16, "Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour, so great riches." You can almost see this is, you can almost hear them crying, "Great riches, my money's gone. This is my God. Can't believe it. Lost it all in 1 hour." Now, you'll notice as we look through these three groups, the sailors, the businessmen, and the leaders, the kings, they're not crying because they're fearful of their souls. You notice that? They're not crying because people have died. They're not crying because people have suffered. Other people have suffered. It's all about who? Me. What I've lost. That's the whole way they think about themselves. What we call the unholy trinity. Me, myself, and I. You know those three persons? You met them? Me, myself, and I. That's what they worship. In the king's case, they're worshiping the loss of power. The merchantmen, the loss of money. But then the third one is the ship masters. Verse 17, "For in 1 hour so great riches is come to naught. And every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city?" They just can't believe it. These shipmen who are on the Euphrates River and on the Persian Gulf, as they see the destruction of the city of Babylon from their ships from a distance, they're just amazed at this destruction. They said, "Look at this great city." They said, "What city is like unto this city?" This city was everything to them also. It seemed invincible, indestructible. You know, there are people like that. They look at their company. Maybe they work for a big brand name company. And they say, "Oh, my company is amazing. It's so powerful. Maybe it's a big bank or a big MNC, you know." And they say, "I work for Shell, or I work for Procter & Gamble, or I work for Singtel, or I work for some other big name in Singapore you see around here." And they say, "Oh, that company can never be destroyed. That company is everything to me. It gives me all my life. My whole future is tied up in it." Well, I remember when I was working. I say working as if I'm not working now. But when I was working outside the church, is that a better way of putting it? One of the banks that we did a lot of business for, we did the legal work for, was Lehman Brothers. Do you remember them? And there was another accountancy firm. There used to be, we talk about the big four accountancy firms. When I was at university, it was the big five. All the young people won't even know what I'm talking about. The big five, there was one called Arthur Anderson. Some of you remember the name of it. Foolishly, I did a test for them and was going to join them as a tax consultant, which I'm glad I never did because of subsequent history. And also, I don't think I'd be very good as a tax consultant. It definitely wouldn't be my cup of tea. But Arthur Anderson were one of the biggest accountancy firms in the world. They were up there with Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche. They're all the same level. They had a big office next door to our university. That's why I applied to them. And Lehman's were one of the biggest merchant banks in the world. Lehman Brothers. And in different situations, through different, slightly different circumstances, Arthur Andersen, if you go today and look up Lehman Brothers, you get a Wikipedia page. You go to Arthur Andersen, you get a Wikipedia page. Why? Because they don't exist anymore. What happened? Both collapsed. Not over a 10-year period. Both collapsed in 24 hours. And there was great weeping and wailing, I remember, because many of the junior accountancy workers, accountants, and Arthur Andersen, and the middle-ranking associates, along with the partners, they had invested their lives into these businesses. And many of them were waiting to become partners, and they had almost reached, you know, the partnership level, the golden pot of money, as they thought. They'd worked long hours, 100-hour weeks, 110-hour weeks, getting themselves to be placed in the partnership rank. They'd given up their family life. They'd given up their social life. They'd invested so much. And then in 24 hours, they just get an email saying, there's no job. There's no company. You have to vacate the premises tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And they all came out with a little wooden box, little cardboard box, with their name tag, a few toys they had at their desk, maybe a picture of their wife and children who they never saw. And they left Arthur Andersen, they left Lehman Brothers, these people that thought they had a big future. And they walked out the door with everything they had left in a cardboard box. What a wake-up call it was. What an illustration it was of how things can be destroyed in just 1 hour. Not even 24 hours. Gone within 1 hour. And if you know the story of how Lehman's and also how Arthur Andersen collapsed, nobody knew what to do because things spiraled out of control. And the directors, everybody was saying, who's in charge? Who can tell us what's happening? Nobody could tell because the directors and the partners, they didn't know either. They had no control over events. Many years ago, I say many years, it's 2001, 9/11. I was in New York the week after 9/11. It just so happened I was in the United States and I was coming back to London through New York. And I went to the bomb site of where the World Trade Center was. It was a terrible sight. It was all dust and everywhere was this gray ash. And when you went along the road, walked down the street, there was all these little shops, you know, jewelers, you know, tailor shops that you get in New York where they, you know, similar to Singapore Orchard Road, where they're always trying to sell knickknacks and trying to sell something to make money. And the shopkeepers were coming out, I still remember it, and they were pulling you by the arm. Never seen it before. Now, this wasn't India or somewhere like that where they tend to be a bit more, you know, pushy. This was America. And they were pulling you by the arm and they were saying, come in. And they were saying this, make us an offer. Anything. Anything. Just make us an offer. They thought everything was destroyed. Their businesses were destroyed. And they had little bits of jewelry and they had little bits of other things. And they were saying, just make an offer. Whatever you want. Offer. So desperate were they. When the World Trade Center came down, they didn't know what would there be a future. They thought their livelihoods were gone. Of course, America recovered. Well, we know that in subsequent history. But I remember that incident because it spoke to me of how fragile the world is. It just takes a couple of airplanes, that's all. And the whole world, not just the United States, the whole world economy shook, didn't it? Just two airplanes crashing into two towers. Well, can you imagine when in the Antichrist Empire, the city of Babylon becomes the financial, political, legal hub of his empire, where everything's controlled from? All the gold is probably based there. All the financial decisions are based there. All the communication systems are based there. Maybe the media is based there. And it all just what? Explodes. Nobody knows what to do. The chaos, the fear, the unknown, the confusion. So now when you think all that, you read this into this chapter. That's what's going on here. And remember, the Antichrist isn't there. He's on his way to Israel for the Battle of Armageddon. So the third group, they rise up, is these merchant salesmen, merchant ships. And they're amazed. They can't believe that this city could go down. They just can't fathom it. They thought this city was invincible. The same way the Lehman brothers, the workers, thought their career was many, many years left. Just gone like that. Everything just gone. And they cry and they say, alas, alas. They take the dust. This is a very Middle Eastern way of showing your sorrow. Even today, the Jews, if their father dies, even a Jewish man in Singapore, they rent their clothes and they put dust. They don't literally, tear off their shirt, because this is a slightly different society than the Middle East of 2,000 years ago. So what do they do? If you go to a Jew today, they get their shirt and they cut, get a pair of scissors and they cut all the ends of their shirt. They take the collar, they cut like this. And then for the whole year, if your father dies, you don't go to any of the festivals, the Passover, the Jewish celebrations, the Yom Kippur, any of those feasts and celebrations. They won't attend. They will sit by themselves in another part of the home, and the rest of the family will celebrate, and the relatives will celebrate. Other friends will come to celebrate all the occasions. And they will sit there, and they wear a shirt that's torn. And they put a little bit of dust, some of them, on top of their head. And it's to show they're in mourning. It's to show that these things are not important to them anymore. They just tear it to show how grief-stricken they are about the loss of their father or their mother. And this is what's going on here. These shipmen it's a very Middle Eastern way of, they still do it today, actually. If you see sometimes in the Middle East, where there was ISIS and all, if someone is, there's a massacre or a bomb, you see them wailing, the women, don't you? And they throw up the dust in the air. It's the same idea. That tradition's been going for thousands of years there. And they say, that great city we're in were made rich, all that had ships in the sea. So these ship captains and sailors, their livelihood, their employment was tied up in the city of Babylon. And now when they sit on their boats and they look, they can say to themselves, am I going to get paid? Have I got a job now? Everything's destroyed. Now, you'll see on your map, because maybe some of you here are saying, well, what relevance has Babylon today? I mean, it's not really a center of anything. Well, this may surprise you. That Persian Gulf, there's a huge amount of the world's trade right now goes through the Persian Gulf. Did you know that? Because in the Middle East, what is their great commodity? Oil. Most of our oil is coming from the Persian Gulf right now, through Singapore, into Singapore. So it's coming from. There's no oil on Sentosa, okay? It'd be nice if it was. But that oil is coming down through the Euphrates River from Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, UAE. And it's coming down often through the Euphrates River, down into the Persian Gulf, and then the great tankers take it all the way around the world, to the countries of the world, like China, like India, who have these vast populations and who need vast energy reserves or resources to feed their people. So when this Babylon, city of Babylon, when the Antichrist seems to be establishing his capital city here during the tribulation period. When that is destroyed, all the trade of the world has been thrown upside down, turned upside down. Nobody knows what to do. Nobody knows who's going to pay the bill. Nobody knows if there's going to be any customers left. Everything's chaotic. Everything's destroyed. And these sailors are weeping and wailing because of that association. They have been made rich by their association with the city of Babylon. Now, you know, this reminds me of Lot in the Old Testament. Do you remember the story of Lot? Well, we talked a little bit about it last week. Lot went to Sodom and Gomorrah not because he liked the architecture of the city. Let's go to Genesis. Let's go to Genesis 13. Let me just show you something. Genesis 13. And we have the incident where the division between Abraham and Lot's servants happens. There's a fight goes on, a strife. And Abraham, in Genesis 13, in verse 8, he calls Lot. Abraham, being a wise man and a spiritual man and a godly man, he says, this just shouldn't go on. We should not be arguing, our people. This is a bad testimony for your servants and my servants to be fighting over water and over land. And Abraham says to him, you choose, verse 9, what way direction you want to go. You go one way or I'll go the other way. You decide. And verse 10 says, Lot's going to make his decision. Now, read carefully how Lot makes his decision. It's very interesting. Verse 10 says this. And Lot lifted up his eyes. By the way, Lot should not have made the decision. He was the nephew. Abraham was the uncle. Lot had got rich through his association with Abraham. He owed everything to Abraham. And Abraham was his superior in terms of culture, but also his spiritual superior. He was a wiser man. Lot should have said, Uncle Abraham, you choose. You're my spiritual superior. You're also my family superior. I will accept whatever choice you make for me and for my family. That's what he should have done. Instead, greedy old Lot, he couldn't believe his luck. You know, Uncle Abraham offered me the choice. Good, I'll take advantage of this. And what does he do? He lifted up his eyes, beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like Eden. But then read on what else it says. Like unto the land of Egypt. Now, the previous chapter, Genesis chapter 12, Abraham went down to Egypt. Do you remember the story? And when he came up out of Egypt, the Bible tells us, that Abraham, verse 2 of chapter 13, Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. Now, before he went to Egypt, the Bible doesn't say he was rich. Please notice this. It doesn't mention he was a wealthy man. But after going down into Egypt, coming up out of Egypt, he came out a very wealthy man. Gold, silver, animals galore, flocks. That's how they measured wealth, of course, by how many animals you had, livestock you had. And Lot, clearly, his heart was still in Egypt, wasn't it? He really was impressed by Egypt, the wealth of Egypt. Because it says when he saw Sodom and Gomorrah, he saw a place that reminded him of Egypt. And what did he want? He wanted more of Egypt. He wanted more money. Now, he was already rich. He wasn't poor. He probably had more than enough to live on for the rest of his days. But Lot craved more. So when he looked at Sodom, all he could see was money. But what does God see? Genesis 13:13. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. That didn't bother Lot. He wasn't attracted by that, to be fair. He wasn't attracted by the architecture. He wasn't attracted by the fact that he could live in a landed property in Sodom. That wasn't what drove Lot. What drove Lot to head towards Sodom was the thought that he could get more money, more possessions. Now, was Lot a believer? Yeah, the Bible says, righteous Lot, just Lot. He's called a righteous man in the New Testament. He's not an unbeliever. He's not a pagan. So what does that tell you and I? That tells you and I that it's possible to make the wrong choice as Christians. Abraham made the right choice. Lot made the wrong choice. Were they both believers? Yes. Were they both contemporaries? Yes. And there are people in the book of Revelation, and their God is Babylon. There are even believers in the tribulation period whose hearts will still be attached to Babylon, the wealth of Babylon. And maybe I'm talking to someone in this room, and deep down your heart is still attached to the things of this world, especially money, especially possessions. Well, I can tell you this, if that's who you are, when the Antichrist comes, you'll be in Babylon. You'll be in Babylon. Now, what does God say over the destruction of Babylon? Verse 20, Revelation 18. God's not mourning the loss of their possessions, their businesses, their gold, their silver. God says, "Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her." God says, instead of mourning, celebrate. Now, why are they celebrating? They're not celebrating because people have died. They're celebrating because God has shown himself righteous. God has been honored by judging sin. That's why they're celebrating. They're celebrating because God has brought vengeance upon the evildoers. God has executed justice. You remember in the Psalms, often King David has what we call imprecatory Psalms, crying unto God to judge the wicked. In the book of Revelation, we're told those who are killed in the tribulation, their souls are under the altar, and they're saying, "Oh Lord, how long before you execute vengeance upon the Antichrist and those who follow him?" And they're told in the book of Revelation, just wait, just wait. God will deal with it. Be patient. And now, in Revelation 18, they're told, rejoice now because God is dealing with it. God is dealing with the Antichrist. God is executing vengeance upon the evildoers. God is showing that he is a righteous God. He is a just God. But then, one last thing, verse 21 to verse 24. A mighty angel picks up a stone like a millstone. Now, have you never seen a millstone? A millstone is a big, huge stone with a hole in the middle. And they use it for grinding out the corn, a millstone. In the Old Testament, someone cast a piece of a millstone down from a city and killed someone, if you remember. So it's a heavy stone. And if you take a big heavy stone like that and you cast it from heaven and it hits the sea, what happens to the stone? Does it float along the sea? No, it immediately does what? Sinks to the bottom. Out of sight. And God says this to this angel. This angel will cast down the millstone out of heaven as a symbol of the destruction of Babylon. Because when the millstone hits the sea from the sky, it does what? It immediately disappears, doesn't it? It doesn't slowly make its way down to the bottom after, you know, 2 or 3 hours. And he says, this is to symbolize the destruction of Babylon. It will be immediately destroyed. No run-up period. Just completely destroyed. And then it will be obliterated, like the millstone lands at the bottom of the ocean, that it can't be seen anymore. It's out of sight permanently. Likewise, Babylon will be destroyed completely, permanently, eternally, never to be rebuilt again. That's what God is saying with the destruction of this city of Babylon. And he tells us that There'll be no more voice of harpers and musicians. Really, what he's saying is there's no more laughter in this place. There's no weddings. There's no more joy. There's no sound of happiness ever in this city again. It's now completely destroyed by God. Completely wiped out by God. Eliminated by God. The candle will not shine there. The voice of the bridegroom. Everything is destroyed. And people will say, ah, but that's very harsh. Why is God so severe? Is God justified in doing that? God defends himself here in verse 23. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth. Yeah, they were big shots in their day. Everybody kowtowed to them, these tycoons, but not now. For by sorceries, thy sorceries, were all the nations deceive. The word sorcery here is the Greek word pharmakia, where we get our word pharmacy from. The Babylonians used drugs in their worship, their rituals. No surprise today, what's one of the biggest scourges in society? Drugs, isn't it? It's only come in the last 160 odd years, it's become very popular in the West. Many of the cities in America, UK, Europe, they're plagued with drugs, drug addiction. People you wouldn't expect, heroin addicts, cocaine addicts, LSD addicts. It's a big, big scourge. I suspect the Antichrist will use a lot of these drugs in their worship to get control of people, to control their minds, control their hearts. Maybe use nightclubs and alcohol along with it. It's no surprise that you see constantly this word, drunk. Have you noticed in the book of Revelation? Drunk. Alcohol is one of the most dangerous drugs for getting you to do something that you wouldn't normally do. Loosening your morals, loosening your conscience, loosening your values. That's what alcohol does. I don't care what anybody says. You'll always find alcohol associated in not just in the Bible, but also in society with immorality. You notice that? Often you open your newspaper and they say, oh, I didn't mean to do it. I was drunk. Whether it's killing someone in a car or committing some act of immorality, they say, I wasn't in control of my senses. Well, why weren't you in control of your senses? Oh, because of the alcohol. Because of the drugs. Well, we're now living in a time where there's a tremendous epidemic of drugs. I know in Singapore we have very harsh laws, and thank God for them. But we are an anomaly. There's not many countries like this one. Most of the so-called developed, I don't know why they call it developed world, because they're pretty undeveloped in their morals and values. But the so-called developed world is plagued with drugs. I remember during the American primary elections, the Republican primary elections, Donald Trump was going to a place that he actually won, New Hampshire. New Hampshire is in the north of the United States. It's a beautiful place. Very small population relative to some other parts. Beautiful state. Some fantastic scenes. Beautiful climate. Beautiful mountains and rivers. You would say it's, you know, picture postcard. You know, those type of places you'd want to go and visit. And he brought up in the election, even though he was an American and he grew up in the United States and had lived there for 70 years, he was shocked when he went to campaign in the state of New Hampshire, how bad was the heroin problem? That the whole state was just riddled with heroin addicts. I remember a friend of mine who, I say a friend, a person I knew, who was formerly a prisoner in jail, got saved, and after he got out of jail, he started to work for this ministry, drug care ministry, in London. And he was visiting one near Heathrow Airport, near where I lived at the time. And he came back from it after his first day there. And I said, well, what did you think? He says, you'll never believe what I've just seen. I said, what did you see? Now, this was a center that gave methadone. It's just like an equivalent. It's to those who are heroin addicts. They give this free methadone to keep them off the heroin. This is the idea. It's a stupid idea, but this is the idea of it. They're just drugged to another drug. Destroy themselves with methadone. And he said, you never believe this. He says, the place is packed with people every morning. I say, what type of people? Bankers, lawyers, doctors from the City of London. They come in the morning, they get their methadone, they get on the train and they go into the centre of London and go to work. He says, I thought there would be all, you know, people who live on the street, people who have no job, people who have no families. These are people with careers. These are people with families. And they're controlled by the drugs. Controlled by the drugs. Thousands of them. Thousands of them. So when you see that word pharmakia, it can mean that they're, you know, in a sense, drugged by the thoughts of the Antichrist Empire. But I think there's an element there of real drugs being involved in that worship, in that system. And then verse 24 gives another reason why God is just to destroy Babylon. In her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. This was a city that shed the blood of God's people. This was a system that persecuted the Jews and the Christians. And God says, I am absolutely righteous to destroy it in 1 hour. They had plenty. Remember this. This city of Babylon is destroyed when? Revelation 18. The tribulation is 3.5, remember? And 3.5. This is Revelation 18 here. Just at the end of the great tribulation. What has happened already? They've had 7 seals, then 7 trumpets, judgments, and then 7 vials, judgments. So they've lived through all these judgments, the people in Babylon at this time. They've had the 144,000 witnesses. They've had the 2 witnesses sent directly by God. They've heard all the sermons. They've seen all the signs. They've seen all the seals and the judgments that God sent upon the earth, all the plagues, and they still rejected the gospel. Is God justified in destroying them now? Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, the city that promoted great evil has now been destroyed. Now wiped out. But there is 2 individuals with an army running around the earth at this moment. The Antichrist and the false prophet, along with their army. And they're making their way to a place called Armageddon. And God is bringing them there because God has a special plan to deal with them there. And next week, God willing, when we come back, we'll discover how God will deal with the Antichrist, the false prophet, and their armies at the Battle of Armageddon. Let us pray. Father, we thank thee for thy word. So many lessons that we can learn about the fragility of life, about how it's so foolish to build our life upon the gods of materialism and power. These things are just temporal. They come and they go. One day God will destroy them all anyway. Help us, Lord, as we live our lives in a materialistic country, that we don't allow it to get into us and consume us and control us. But Lord, help us just to live our lives in a way that pleases thee. Yes, we need material things in order to live. We understand that. But we don't need to make them an idol. We don't need to make them our God. Help us to keep our focus on the one who is eternal, the one who is coming, and the one who will bring us to an eternal home. This world is not our home. This Red Hill Church building is not our home. Our home is in heaven. And we look forward to that wonderful day when we'll be with your people over there. For we ask all of these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.